This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe. RedIceCreations.com.
Welcome back to Red Ice Radio, friends, new and regular listeners. We're always glad to have you with us. My name is Henrik, and this is the radio program where we discuss a vast array of different topics that are essential and interesting. We follow the threads wherever they may lead. We are free to consider the ideas that we like without preconceived ideas about the mysteries of this world. As I hope you know, we are not on any network, and hence we are 100% independent and free from commercial interruptions and blinking banners. More importantly, we are not here to tell you what to think about the material that we present. We always leave it up to you to decide for yourself and use your discernment if it makes sense to you or not. RedIceCreations.com, that is the website, RedIceCreations.com. Today we're talking to author, engineer, designer, and green builder Matthew Stein, who was born and raised in Burlington, Vermont. He graduated from MIT in 1978 with a major in mechanical engineering. Matt has built hurricane and earthquake-resistant, energy-efficient, and environmentally friendly homes. He has also designed consumer water filtration devices, solar PV roofing panels, medical bacteriological filters, emergency chemical drench systems, and much more. And he's with us today to discuss six major trends that he calls civilization busters. And if any of these trends don't change soon, it may well be the perfect storm. We'll also talk about shifting to sustainability, the free market, consumers' responsibility, and government regulation. Stay with us for much more. Welcome to Red Ice Radio, Matthew Stein. It's really good to have you with us. This is going to be really interesting. First of all, thank you for coming on. How are you today, Matt?
Oh, you're welcome, and thank you, Henrik, for having me on today. It's a beautiful day here in the High Sierras, and I'm really excited about being on your show today.
Thank you so much for that. This is going to be really interesting. You have a long bio. You have done a lot of different things in your life. You have a lot of outdoor activity, obviously, behind you. You've been a mountain climber. You've been doing a lot of things when it comes to building and constructing things. But where I like to begin today to kind of set some of the background here is to talk about a little bit about how you got basically the idea for the book When Technology Fails, how that came to you. I think that that's a really interesting place to begin, Matt.
Well, it is very interesting. I'm an MIT engineer. I graduated in 1978, Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering. I've been a kind of backcountry guy all my life. My parents took me hiking and skiing from basically the time I could walk, and hunting, fishing, all that stuff in the mountains of New England, Vermont, New Hampshire, New York. But I never considered myself a survivalist, even though I certainly had concerns about the way the world was headed in the long-term sustainability of our world. But back in 1997, roughly Thanksgiving of 1997, at that point in time, I'd had a 20-year practice of morning prayer and meditation. Nothing fanatical. I just found it was a great way to start my day. I'd kind of do some breathing exercises and some mantras and quiet, nice quiet time. I'd get a little bit of inspiration here and then. And back in that day in 1997, I made a very generic request for guidance and inspiration, something that many of us have probably done hundreds of times in our life. And on that day, I got a bomb dropped in my lap. What I got was a holographic storyboard outline, call it a vision, in great detail, roughly 30 sort of moving pictures, like an artist might sketch on a storyboard the outline for scenes from a movie in graphic detail. Well, I received graphic detailed outline for a massive book project to help people to both live more sustainably as well as cope with and deal with long-term failures of our high-tech society. Now, this was really hard for me to handle. I mean, it instantaneously it was all dumped into my head. One moment it wasn't there, and the next moment it was there. And my first thought, well, honestly, was no effing way. I mean, I don't know all this stuff. I can't possibly do this. And I'm an engineer. I'm not a writer. And the little voice in my head, Jesus refers to it as the still small voice, the little voice inside my head said, well, nobody knows it all. And it assured me that I had the skills and talents that should I decide to take this project on, this assignment, and it always felt much more like my assignment than my idea, that I would receive the inner and the outer help I needed to complete the project, meaning that with my dogged determination and MIT background, that I would dig up all of the experts and reference materials I needed to fill in the holes in my background, and that the intuitional guidance, the inner guidance, would kick in and would provide me with writing help and direction as to how to compose and where to go with what I wrote. Well, I didn't just jump right up and say, you know, God talked to me today and I'm going to write this really cool book that'll help people deal with the coming difficult times. It took me about a year to decide that it was actually a good idea, that maybe I could actually do it, and about another year to write a sample chapters and a book proposal and get a publisher to cut a deal and give me a small advance. And then the third year, I really had to, you know, tighten the belt and bite the bullet. I racked up the credit cards, worked 70 hours a week, put my engineering design business mostly on hold, and made it happen in the third year. So I figured over the 3 years of work on When Technology Fails, Edition 1, back in 1978 through 2000, I had about 2 years of labor over a three-year period of time, and then I put about another year's worth of labor in 2008 into buying bunches of books, reading books, and updating the material. So it's a pretty up-to-date edition now. I did that in 2008. So I figured about 3 years of my life and all the equity in my home involved in this book, and it's quite apparent now why I needed to write such a book. But back in 1997, realized that's when .com was booming, business in America couldn't be better, oil was at a 30-year low when you factored in inflation. And, you know, on the outside, everything looked good. But it's interesting, as I worked on this book, I was focusing on chapters I was comfortable with at first when I was working on the proposal and on the building chapters. And I've been a contractor and a carpenter. I took time off from engineering to be a carpenter and then have since become a contractor. And I was focusing on the water chapter. I designed water filters, and so I'm an expert on water treatment and quality and things like that. And then the little voice chimed in my head and said, well, you got to focus on this chapter number 2 called Present Trends, Possible Futures, about the future of the world. And it was like, oh, damn, I thought I was almost done with this proposal. Now it's telling me to write another chapter.
Right.
Well, as I started focusing on that and reading the best writings from the top scientists and ecologists in the world, I realized that our planet, when this is going on, is like 1998, 1999. And at that point in time, I'm reading all these writings, and the term peak oil hadn't even been invented yet for another 2 or 3 years. And I'm realizing that our world is in much bigger trouble than I thought. Here I thought of myself as a fairly ecologically aware kind of guy, you know, somewhat green, you know, involved a little bit with solar energy, alternative energy. And I start reading these things, and I realize that our world is much closer to systemic collapse than I had previously imagined. And certainly now, you know, 10 years later, it's quite apparent that our world's in major trouble. Yep. And that we're headed for a brick wall if we keep doing what we've been doing.
I believe you're right. I think something's got to give. We can't just keep doing the same things over and over and expect different results in a sense. That's the definition of insanity, as it were. Why right. Do you think that this was important, for you to get this opportunity to get the book out? Obviously, you tapped into the muse, the source of creativity, whatever you want to call it, and you know, since you asked for it, you received right. this idea, you know, in that sense. So why do you feel that this was important at the time then, if things weren't so bad for you?
Well, things weren't so bad for me, but the trends, it's like a speeding freight train that takes a long time to slow down. Or think about the Titanic. You know, by the time they saw the iceberg at the speed the Titanic was going, they just simply didn't have enough time to slow down and change course to avoid hitting that iceberg. And we're basically in that situation right now. It's like we're on the speeding Titanic headed for an iceberg, and people are sounding the alarm, and they're saying, slow down, whoa, we got to change course. It's like, Einstein has been quoted as saying, as you said, in definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. So I've since written an article called The Perfect Storm, Six Trends Converging on Collapse. And to be honest with you, these are six major trends. Each one is a potential civilization buster. We so far, the scientists are talking about them. They're aware of each of these trends. Nobody's in the dark about them. But we haven't succeeded in even slowing down, much less changing course on any one of these six trends. And so, you know, as a high school student drawing graphs, if a graph is headed steeply for the bottom, if you don't do something different, it's going to hit the bottom. Mm. I mean, you got to do something significantly different, or that trend that's taken that graph down is going to go all the way to the end, which is collapse. And that's the position we're in. So the book is, half of it is about living green and clean and healthy while the world is still working reasonably well. And the other half is about how do you replicate the 18th century technologies that people in our grandparents' age, somebody in our grandparents' era, knew how to make, grow, build, or fabricate pretty much everything needed for a reasonable standard of living. So if the world's global economy just totally falls apart and things stop working, I'd much rather slip back to an 18th century lifestyle and technology than to back to a Mad Max caveman era. And so that's what, you know, half of my book is about. You know, it is how do you make do with what you got?
Yeah.
If it comes to that.
Generally speaking, we don't know that much today when it comes to producing certain things, basic engineering to get back up on our feet if something happened. Obviously, I want to run through some of these possible scenarios, what might happen and so forth. There's a major important stuff in all of this. But why do you think it is the course that we've taken, in a sense, is, you know, people know computer programming, for instance, very much today, but there's very few that are focusing on some of the basics out there. Is that just because we're kind of on that curve of trying to, you know, I'm not saying necessarily that it's advancing, but we're progressing, we're going forward in one direction. But it's kind of, it's volatile when we drop off the things behind us, in a sense, isn't it, Matt?
That's right. I mean, the people, to be honest with you, the people in the third world, if any one of a number of scenarios takes down sort of the big giant machine that keeps 7 billion people reasonably well fed, not all, you know, the top billion, 3 billion at least, reasonably well fed, reasonably clean water, reasonable sources of food. It's a complex machine that keeps that going for the, you know, top half of the world in the more developed nations than the lower side. But if that thing falls apart, then, you know, how many of us know how to tan leather or, you know, make shoes or weave cloth and spin thread and spin yarn? I mean, those are things that unless you're out there practicing old-fashioned technologies, chances are you haven't got a clue as to how any of that goes. How many of you could dig clay out of the riverbank and pit fire some pottery? I mean, I've done that, but most of us haven't. And how many of you could go mine some feldspar and make a kiln and blow glass? I mean, come on. those are not skills that the average human being, in certainly in America and in Europe, has any clue about how to do it.
That's right. There is a few little groups that more and more are beginning to look into some of this stuff. And I guess that this is obviously wasn't as popular back in the late 90s, perhaps. But today we have people like opensourceecology.com. They're coming up with these open source basic blueprints for machinery that has to do with basic farm machines. So we can plow, you know, how do you build a basic tractor and things like that. I don't know how aware you are of that, but to me anyway, when I look at that kind of stuff, that's a positive sign that someone at least out there, more than you as well, Matt, are thinking about these things and trying to make it available for free to the public, which is great.
I think it is great, and there's a collective conscious awareness in the world as we know it, and Paul Hawken wrote this really wonderful book called Blessed Unrest. And when he started researching, he found that in recent years, there was something like 500,000 independent organizations around the planet have become dedicated to social and ecological change. Well, as they've updated it, they now realize it's like a couple million organizations. So what that means is that humanity collectively is getting it, that we're in trouble, that the way we're doing business is soiling the nest, is ruining the world. I mean, 90% of the large fish, commercial fish in our oceans are gone. You know, every single large commercial fish species in the ocean, 90% or more depleted. That's basically either already collapsed or quite close to it. And you get, you know, half of the world's forests are gone and the other half are significantly degraded. You know, things like in the last, from the year 2000, in the last decade, more people have been added to the population of our world than from the time Jesus walked the earth until Abraham Lincoln. So think of that, 1,800 years from Jesus' birth to Abraham Lincoln, more people in the last 10 years added to our world than in the 1,800 years from the Jesus to Abraham. I mean, that's mind-boggling. Hmm. And when you think of from the start of the year 2000 to the year to the October of 2011, just under 12 years, more people added to the planet than the entire population of the world just 200 years ago. Hmm. So it's like a whole planet's worth of people every 12 years. I mean, come on, we can't keep that up much longer. We're depleting things all over the place, and it's happening exponentially. And back in the 70s, when I was at MIT, though I had no clue this was going on then, in retrospect, I wish I'd gotten to know these people. They did this limits to growth. They did a big computer program called World 3 with systems analysis. And they started looking at these trends in the planet, and basically, without proactively intervening in the way we do things, they showed in scenario after scenario after scenario that the inevitable result of current trends was this incredible growth logarithmically, exponentially of consumption on the planet that all of a sudden ends in catastrophic falling off the cliff and collapse when one system after another natural system of the world fails because they're overstressed and pushed to the limit in the last valiant efforts to try and keep the giant machine of consumption going. And that's basically where we're at right now. We've seen, like, when I was a kid in the 60s, it was half the world's population. Most of the natural systems of the planet were starting to show some minor symptoms of stress, but other than tiny little hotspots here and there, most of the planet was doing okay. Mm-hmm. Well, now there's massive, like, red flags going up all over the planet. And that's just in the last 40 years. We've gone from tiny little hotspots to like huge problem areas and major red flags.
We have so much going on specifically when it comes to the food production as well. Depleted, the topsoil layer is being depleted. No nutrition is left in that. And then we have, on top of that, we have lots thrown away as well. Here over in the EU, the bureaucracy, and I know it's happening in the American farming industry as well, certain things are subsidized, which means that, you know, we have massive consequences on food production around the world, you know, and large quantities of food, good food, is being thrown away because farmers are being, you know, run by a central system in that sense, instead of having local farm industry, for instance, where you just basically kind of try to tap into the demand of the local area. Okay, what do we need, you know, this year or next year, whatever, and then you plan ahead locally in a small area. Now we have, you know, farmers all over Europe producing red grapes because they want to make cheap red wine, and we've had so much waste of I think someone compared it to a lake of cheap red wine that's just been poured, you know, away into the ground, basically, because no one could drink it, but it was cheaper, or the farmers could actually make money on it. Wow. So this central system on top of this that is trying to regulate things, in my view, just make it much, much, much worse than if we had a local farming, you know, for the community, basically, Matt.
Well, certainly the transition town movement, you know, if people wonder, like, how do we... I know we're going to talk about, like, 400 Chernobyls and solar storm and EMP and potential radical game-changing events that could happen in very short term on our planet, but you know, both in the long term from the peak in world oil production, or short term from radical problems like solar storms or a nuclear EMP, the transition town movement provides at least reasonable solutions for maintaining local economies and local communities in ways that life can go on in a reasonable way in the event that something is causing kind of a shutdown of the world global economy. And we're certainly seeing economic shutdown happening now, but yeah. We could see much bigger wrenches in the spokes than the current ones happening, and we can get into them whenever you feel like it.
Absolutely. I would think we should try to kind of get into that a little bit. Maybe you can run through for us some of the possible future scenarios. You mentioned these six. Maybe we can, if we have time, run through all of them shortly, or some of the most plausible in that short list of basically of what could happen, what you see some of the dangers are here, in a sense.
Well, okay, let's just go briefly through the six trends. I've already touched on some of them, but the six trends, and again, there's more than six, but these are like six major trends that are converging on collapse. It's what I call the perfect storm. One is climate change or global weirding, I like to call it. I mean, most everybody who's 30 years or more older knows that the climate is much less stable and erratic now than it was when we were younger. And I believe that there are certain, and any good climatologist looks at both the influence of the sun, the influence of orbits, like for instance, historically, sometimes Jupiter and Saturn line up with the Earth and pull it to a longer orbit where it's further from the sun and we get into an ice age, or they line up on the opposite side and they pull it closer to the sun, we get into an excessively hot period, and then there's volcanic periods. But now certainly we have on top of that, we have mankind's influence. So they're talking about a 6 degree centigrade potential change within the century, which is game changing in terms of wiping out the breadbaskets that currently feed our planet. And so, you know, that's just one threat. I'm not going to focus on the global climate change because there's a lot of controversy over it. But in most countries outside of America, it's not a political scene. In America, it's like if you're on the conservative side, you think global climate change is just a hoax. If you're on the more liberal side, you think the science backs it up. But over most of the world, they basically, right or left or center, they look at it and say, yeah, the science indicates that we're, you know, mankind's having a big effect on the planet. Okay. Number two is peak in world oil production. We talked about that briefly. But essentially, every oil field in the world has a life cycle where it gets discovered. It takes about 10 years after they decide to start developing it till the infrastructure's really in and it's producing well. And then it produces, and they keep adding more and more wells, and it has a peak, and then it starts declining. So there's something like six giant fields in the world, Saudi Arabia's Ghawar being one of them, Mexico's Cantrell being another one of them. And Mexico's Cantrell is currently depleting like 25% a year. It's almost going off a cliff. Mexico's been a huge exporter of oil, and it's what's provided a tremendous amount of income to the Mexican government, much like the North Sea oil has provided a huge amount of income to the UK government. But the North Sea, at least as far as the UK is concerned, is going off a cliff and depleting quite rapidly and no longer providing more oil than the UK can use. The UK is an importer again, and Mexico is about to be in the same level. And certain places like Sweden and Norway, they were more judicious with their use of the oil. So they're getting to sell their oil at $140 a barrel, or, you know, in however many euros that is, whereas the UK sold their oil legacy for $10 a barrel, and now they get to import it at $100, $140 a barrel. So it's like, where's the wisdom in that? Anyway, number three, we as far as the world's concerned, with regular, easy to refine, easy to find oil, we passed that peak in about 2005, 2006. Mm-hmm. We've been making up for the loss in the peak with biofuels and tar sands. You know, things are much more expensive, have much less energy return on energy invested, and those have been basically keeping our world production of oil equivalent distillates at roughly flat for the last 6 to 7 years. But we really passed the peak in the good stuff back in 2005, 2006, and we're never going to see that come back again, as far as I can tell, without some huge technological change. I mean, we're doing the fracking thing now, which has its own set of ecological problems.
Oh, yeah, that's
claiming in America that it's going to solve our problems, but it's like, you got to drill, baby, drill, baby, drill. I mean, with you have to drill 200 wells fracking to keep up with a single regular oil well, like in the Gulf of Mexico. Mm-hmm. You know, in other words, you drill one big well in the Gulf of Mexico, or you drill 200 wells in Bakken, up oil field and fracking up in North Dakota. And those wells last a very short while, and they got to keep drilling, drilling, drilling. Very bad in the ecosystems. You get waste tons of fresh water, ruin aquifers, all kinds of terrible stuff.
Yeah, anyway, turn the planet into a Swiss cheese in the process, yeah.
Yeah, yep, plant it into cheese, and lots of people going to get cancer from drinking the water because all those carcinogens get into the aquifers. You know, terrible stuff.
Yep.
Number three, collapse of the world's oceans. It's not just the fisheries. There's acidification. Every time, when we burn fossil fuels, it goes in the atmosphere, makes carbon dioxide, combines with water, comes down, becomes carbolic acid, makes for acid rain, but that rain all ends up in the ocean, and we're changing the pH of the oceans. It's killing the coral reefs. The planktons are the bottom of the food chain, and they're bigger than, as far as the carbon-oxygen cycle on the planet, they're even more important than the rainforests. And the planktons, there's a British Society study that showed that 73% of the world's zooplanktons have gone away since the 1950s, over half of that since 1990.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're knocking out the bottom of the food chain, and the phytoplanktons are also depleting, but not as severe as the zooplankton. So we're changing the basic chemistry and the health of our oceans and our forests and our atmospheres all over. So number four was the forest. When you chop down forests, you change the weather downwind. You have something called desertification goes on. See, one large, giant, old-growth tree, whether it's deciduous or coniferous, meaning pine needles or leaves, every single large tree acts like a giant water pump. So when the rain falls, the tree's roots suck up the moisture and put it out into the needles and leaves. And the sun evaporates that moisture and it goes back into the sky and falls as rain downstream. Now, when you cut those big trees down, supposedly one of giant trees equal to the evaporative surface acre of a 20-acre lake. Hard to imagine, it's a number that came from Tom Hartman's Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight book. I'd like to do the calculation to check it, but I'm going to give you that number. So when you cut down the trees downwind, all of a sudden you start losing moisture. So a place like in modern civilization, the birth of modern civilization was an area called the Fertile Crescent between the Tigris and Euphrates River. It was essentially the Garden of Eden. And it was such a wonderful climate that human beings grew and multiplied 10,000 years ago, and they started farming and the irrigation. They cut the trees down and, you know, they expanded and built civilization. Well, that Garden of Eden is Iraq now. It's all desert land. So they cut all the trees down and they irrigated and then salted the land eventually from irrigation, evaporation, and changed the weather. And the Fertile Crescent is now, a very unproductive desert region for the most part.
Mm.
Okay, number five is the food crisis. We touched on that already. We're depleting the soils. We have water crisis. We have six major rivers in the world now that run dry or nearly dry for significant parts of the year, from the Colorado in the United States, the Chao Phraya, the Indus River, the Yellow River in China first ran dry in the 1970s for 2 weeks. And in recent years, it's gone dry for almost 300 days out of the year. It doesn't reach the ocean. So this is a huge deal, and then when you throw on top of that the climate change, then you're looking at a huge crisis trying to feed the world's population. And number six is the population that we touched on already, and essentially we can't keep adding a billion people every 12 years to our population much longer. We're crashing the system, and if we don't do something ourselves proactively quite soon, then Mother Nature will take care of it. And in Mother Nature, what happens when you soil a nest is something called bloom and crash. And so to give you an example of that, back in the late 40s, early 50s, somebody got a bright idea that there's this island in the Bering Sea between Alaska and Russia called St. Matthew's Island. And in St. Matthew's Island in 1944, they put a small herd of reindeer onto the island. Only 29 reindeer in 1944. Well, by 1957, those 29 reindeer, with no predators and abundant food, grew to 1,350 reindeer. Now, in 1963, just 6 years later, that 1,350 had more than quadrupled to over 6,000 reindeer. Well, it turns out that from looking at similar-sized islands in other places, the what's called the carrying capacity of an island that size with that kind of growth on it was about 1,500 reindeer. So, you know, roughly 2,000. So basically, they had three times as many reindeer on the island as the island could support mm-hmm. without causing problems. So right. What did these reindeer do? They ate everything in sight. All the plants were gone. They ate the lichens, the mosses, everything. The soils washed away in the rains. And in 3 years, from 1963 population of over 6,000 reindeer, in just 3 years, they crashed to 42 reindeer. That's what nature does when we overshoot our natural systems and deplete the natural systems. Then you have what's called a crash. So it went from 6,000 reindeer down to 42 in just 3 years' time.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, in the mid-70s, the last starving, lonely, sickly reindeer died on St. Matthew's Island. So they went from a population of 6,000 in 1963 to about 15 years later, there wasn't a single one left.
Mm.
And so that's what we face if we soil the nest radically, and we're headed that direction.
That's a very interesting example, because we have a number of things there that we could argue and talk about in a sense, because that's like, there wasn't any rain there to begin with on the island, so that's man's doing in a sense, and that's usually when things get screwed up. Nature has a balance, which is, I believe anyway, well, maybe not from our perspective, because we might not agree with it, but in itself, it's a perfect system if we let it be, in a sense, and things will balance back to where it's supposed to be. And this happened obviously on the island. Hopefully the plants there can grow back or you know, retain that in some way. But what if we, and I mean a few of these as well are we can look at the, you know, there are some different theories here. We know that there's theories about abiotic oil, you know, climate gate issues when it comes to the cooking of the books. There's a number of stuff there, but
right.
We don't have to go into all of that right now. What you're laying out there is six different possibilities. There are, you know, points of arguments we can have about those points, of course, but in any regard, all of these things taken in together, just one of these needs to unfold properly, in a sense, for this to be a disaster on us, in a sense, or for us.
That's correct. Just one of these causes. One of these causes of problems, and if one or two of these things, you know, maybe there's adiabatic oil and it's actually reproducing at a fast enough rate to keep up with our consumption, which is hard to believe, or wouldn't have depleting major oil fields all over. I mean, I grant we may well have adiabatic oil, but chances that it's replenishing at the rate that we're consuming is pretty slim. So anyway, it doesn't really matter. If one or two of these trends turns out to be non-man-made, fine. You know,
sure.
It leaves the other four left.
That's right. That's
fine.
Right. So what do you think if we run through it? Obviously, we're going to get into the Carrington event and some of the interesting other stuff here, things that are, I mean, these six that you run through in some regard, obviously, are within our control, our own doing. Something like the Carrington event and upcoming major solar flare is not, as far, you know, as we know with our current technology anyway. But what's the solution to this? Is it to adopt green technology? People talk about free energy out there, shifting our way, our thinking. Is it going into space, depleting other planet and their resources? What do you see as an outcome of this for us to keep up with what we're doing right now, if there is such a thing?
Well, there is such a thing. And the last chapter of When Technology Fails is called Making the Shift to Sustainability. Now, you know, here's an interesting observation. When I give talks, I talk to people in the left, right, and center, because the survivalists love my book, except for, of course, some of the ecological things they have a hard time with, and the fact that I actually believe that maybe humankind is screwing up our climate, you know, makes me a bad guy in their eyes. I must be an Al Gore windup, but whatever.
Mm-hmm.
When I ask people, I speak, you know, to crowds from 50 to hundreds, 500 to 1,000 people, and I ask people, how many of you in my audience think everything's okay, we can keep going the way we're going, it's going to be okay? A have not yet seen a single hand raised when I asked that question.
Yep.
Not yet.
Yep.
Then I asked people, how many think that we passed the tipping point, that we're on the giant train, you know, we're in the big train, we're headed for the stone wall at the end of the tracks, and no matter what we do, it's too late, we can't slow down, we're going to crash, and the giant train wreck's going to happen. And in the past, usually about one out of three people raised their hand. Then I asked the question, how many of you think that we got to get shaken up really bad, like way worse than Hurricane Katrina, way worse than, you know, the Gulf oil spill. Some big event's going to shake us up really badly, and then we stand a chance of making the radical shifts in the way we do business in our world, and we can avoid collapse. And then my hand and usually two out of three people's hands show up. Well, the interesting thing is, in the last year, most of the time when I ask that question, now two out of three hands think we have the unavoidable giant train wreck coming up, and only one out of three is the optimistic doomer like myself, where they actually think that we stand a chance of waking up and avoiding collapse. Now, we're talking major changes, and here's part of the problem right now, and this is where financial collapse may be necessary in order to avert ecological worldwide collapse. Because when you think about the free market system, if I'm a CEO of a large corporation, my responsibility is to my stockholders to maximize profit. Now, in an unregulated free market, what does that mean? That means I go to that place in the world where wages are lowest, concern for the ecosystems is lowest, and where government regulations are the least, so that I can maximize my profit. It also means that I must, there's a limited number of resources out there, limited amount of lumber, limited amount of minerals and rare earths, limited amount of fish, you know, limited amount of arable land. So it means if I'm to maximize profit, I must take those resources and consume them and, you know, use them to manufacture products to maximize my profit while the resources are still there before somebody else get them. So it means in an unregulated free market, rather than regulating itself to save the world, it guarantees that the natural systems of the world will be consumed and used up in as quick and as efficient a way as possible to maximize profit before the next guy can get them. So it's the tragedy of the commons to the maximum. So what it means, quite logically, is that without mindful, sustainable regulation, the current system dooms our planet to collapse and most of the population dying. So then you say, a very cool tool called backcasting. People say, well, how are we going to make the world we want without collapsing? And part of the problem is that it's like Einstein says, is that you can't solve the problems from the same level of thinking that created the problems to begin with. Mm-hmm, you've got to solve them from an improved, higher level of thinking.
Right.
So backcasting says, okay, let's start with the end in mind and work backwards. So envision a future, a global renaissance, where the natural systems of the world have been stabilized and are recovering, where the population of the world has been stabilized and is decreasing, where, you know, poverty is gone, and where, you know, inhuman suffering is gone, and all of those things that you love to see solved are gone. Imagine that utopian future. And then say, well, how did we get there? And you start stepping backwards. And then you start seeing steps along the way. It's called backpasting. You go backwards, a step back, a step back, a step back from the end. And you're not bound by the limited thinking that got us into those critical game-changing problems we're facing today. Mm. So then you look at it and you say, okay, well, it's clear. You know, we got rid of the nuclear power plant problems that we've got right now. Not to say there's not some nuclear energy system, like low-energy nuclear reactions, that doesn't produce waste, that produces abundant energy. That, you know, there's several people close to commercializing right now, almost free energy. You know, there's a number of different things, but you start looking at the solutions. You say, oh, funding, it's quite clear. If we got to the end, we have to change the way we fund political systems in the, quote, free world, and that we have to take the money out of it, because right now it costs so much money to be a president or a prime minister that basically you're bought and paid for by the people with the money, and the people with the money got there through the system being the way it is now. So that part of the problem is that The people at the top got to the top by making money through the system the way it is now. And if that same system is also killing the planet. So the people who got into power got where they are. They have a stake in keeping the system going the way it is. Unfortunately, doing that is also killing the planet. So it's like, it's not an easy problem, and I don't claim to have the solutions, but I do believe the solutions are there. And it's just, but it's going to, it's like, how do we, without entirely wrecking the system, how do we get it going in the right direction? And to be honest with you, it's probably going to take a pretty big train wreck. In order to stop where the way we're going,
unfortunately,
so we can pick up the pieces and go in the right direction. I mean, that's my personal belief.
Yeah.
I could be. I hope I'm wrong. You know. I'd love to be wrong.
Yeah, you could be right. I mean, this gluttonous, you know, push for more and more and more, the greediness in that sense of the world of politics that basically has been turned into corporatism today, or fascism by the true definition of the world, is just eating everything up. And but again, we have this question of morals, obviously, in this as well. There has to be a level, an awareness in people who are, after all, the consumers, if you will, and of these products, to have an awareness enough to stop purchasing from these companies. We're in an interesting situation right now when it comes to the information flow. More and more we can talk with each other, obviously, globally, over the network in that sense. And what I see anyway is maybe not only go down the route of regulation, because there is another, you know, there's a backdoor in that as well for even those who have the money. We understand that, because at the end of it, if they are the ones who write the regulation, they can still write things that are, you know, advancements for them, for the monopolies, for the corporatist structure. But if people had an awareness, a consciousness, and a level of morals where they understood, okay, who am I buying from, in a sense? What is this company in the grand scheme of things, and see through, obviously, the wall of corporate propaganda that is out there today. I mean, every company talks about green this and green that, and it doesn't really mean that they actually are that. So it's difficult to see through it, you know, in that sense. But I personally am a believer in a change of human consciousness, and therefore we don't have to have endless amounts of regulations and codes that you have to, you know, stick to. It's just a basic level of understanding and doing the right thing in your heart, and combining that with a level of intelligence, in a sense. Isn't that, you know, pretty simple?
Well, but see, doing the right thing is easy on an individual basis, except then you've got the, you know, the economic thing of, like, I'm struggling to keep my family afloat. So do I buy from Walmart, or do I buy locally? You know, do I buy from the giant low-cost global distributor in the big box franchise?
Yeah.
Or do I buy locally? You know, what can I afford to do? And so, doing the right thing individually is only part of the solution, because without the government, for instance, in the United States, the fossil fuel industry bitches and moans that solar and wind can only survive with subsidies. Well, it turns out that due to tax write-offs and subsidies, the fossil fuel and nuclear guys get $10 in subsidies and kickbacks and tax write-offs for every single dollar that goes to sustainable, renewable technologies. Mm. And so if that was switched around, if the sustainable guys got 10 for every one that went to the fossil fuels, they'd be miles ahead of where they are right now. And right now, today, I mean, nuclear is like the most expensive and the least safe, you know, of all of these things. And wind power goes head-to-head with coal, even with the subsidy inequalities. And you have solar that's somewhere around the level of nuclear, but if you switch the tax and the subsidies, then solar would actually be a far ahead of nuclear already. So you've got, you know, here you've got things where, in order to shift the world to sustainability, change has to happen from the top down and the bottom up. So the bottom up is change on the local community level, change in the individual level, but the top down is change in terms of the tax structure. Because so long as it's more profitable to do things in the wrong way, they're going to keep getting done in the wrong way, because the corporate CEOs are saying, and God, the bottom line is the God, and I've got to, If my company goes down because I try to do things in the right way and somebody else does them in the wrong way, and my company goes down because of that, then I'm guilty to my stockholders and I've done the wrong thing. So doing the wrong thing for the planet is right now the opposite in many cases of doing the wrong thing for your stockholders. And so we've got to, that's where top-down management has to happen. It because of those big tax structure kinds of things of what we support and, you know, setting a bar and saying everything below this bar is going to be penalized through the tax structure or, you know, some kind of penalties, and everything above the bar is going to get supported with tax rebates or tax, you know, in other words, we have to start on a national level and global level supporting doing things sustainably and penalizing things doing non-sustainably, or we're never going to get there. It ain't going to happen without the big train wreck, you know, and I prefer to avoid the train wreck myself.
I agree. There's I personally am a believer and hope that we do will come a day here pretty soon where we can actually see some new, really off the wall, you know, outside of the box kind of technology, new technology that is being worked on. You know, ECAT, you mentioned low, you know, nuclear level reaction, things like that. There's tons of stuff happening out there right now, and it's a pretty exciting time in that sense. And I think we're in a time when things are really bad in that sense, but that's also a time when mankind begins to think outside of the box. You know, that's when they actually bother to come up with a new solution, in a sense, to the problem that we didn't even know exist. We've done it in the past, and hopefully we can continue to do it before it's, you know, too late, in a sense. That's what I'm hoping for.
Well, the energy part is a big part, but, you know, we still have to solve the population and the other things. But, you know, there's some really encouraging signs. I mean, for instance, if you look at Brazil, Brazil's a country with a high third world population, a lot of poverty, very high Catholic population, high percentage of Catholics. And yet in the last 10 years, Brazil went from a very high population growth rate to essentially a sustainable level, replacement level right now. In 10 years' time, they've gone from very high rate of growth to sustainable replacement level. And they've done that through education, not through the government type of education, but it sort of nonprofit organizations that sponsor, like global population media, that goes to different countries and hires local writers and local artists, and they make these soap operas on TV and on radio, and they show like a family that has seven children and they're starving and they're having a horrible time keeping, you know, feeding them, and they've got terrible problems. They can't have health care or anything. And then they have other people who actually use birth control and have a smaller, more manageable family. And so, and they do things like AIDS awareness and population control awareness through popular media and through, you know, through soap operas and through fiction, and that's made a huge impact in a country like Brazil, and they're working in other places. So that's an example of a place where it didn't take a high standard of living. Now, granted, Brazil is doing quite well economically compared to much of the world, but still, as a whole, there's a lot of poverty in that country and a lot of Catholics in that country, and so they've done remarkably well on this issue given their demographics. And so though there are shining examples of that around the planet, and there's a wonderful book also called Cradle to Cradle, and they talk about how you can design industrial processes and systems so that you're from the ground up, you're doing things in such a way that the planet is better off or no worse off. For instance, they did a textile plant in England based on these concepts from cradle to cradle. See, in nature, everything happens from cradle to cradle, meaning like a tree is born, it grows, its leaves fall, and it makes the earth richer, and its fruit makes the earth richer, and it makes the atmosphere cleaner and better. So for having grown and lived its life, the tree leaves the world a better place. But mankind is operating from a cradle to grave kind of thing, where, you know, we make all this stuff out of the planet, we build it up, we make cars and this and that. And even when we recycle, usually it's downcycling, meaning like you take a newspaper and you recycle it, and in the paper that comes out of the newspaper is more toxic and less useful than the paper you started with in the newspaper. So even if it's recycled, it's downcycled. It's not as valuable when it's done, whereas the earth is cradle to cradle, man's cradle to grave. So when you design natural, when you design industrial systems and building systems in the planet for a cradle to cradle mentality, so that when you're done, whatever is used becomes food for something else, becomes a product that can be built into something else of equal or greater value, then all of a sudden we're not having such a negative impact on the planet. And we can, you know, we could design all of our systems from that cradle to cradle point of view instead of cradle to grave. So there's a lot of shining examples in small, you know, instances here and there of how we can do the right thing. And it needs to be done on a very large scale if we're going to avoid the train wreck.
Now, what I'd like to do is actually begin running off for the first segment here, take a little break in a little while, and obviously get into the Carrington event, the 400 Chernobyls in the next segment, and save it for there because we just don't have time in this first one here. But why don't we talk a little bit about your titles again? I want to give it out to your websites, make sure that you mention those, of course. The first book that you wrote on is called When Technology Fails, a manual for self-reliance, sustainability, and surviving the long emergency. There was a revisit and updated version of that then, I guess, back in 2008. And then the latest one you've out is called When Disaster Strikes, a comprehensive guide to emergency planning and crisis survival. Where do we go to pick up copies of these books, Matt?
Well, you can, I mean, I realize that many people are in Europe and they do have them on Amazon and in major booksellers in Europe. I think Green Books and there's Walnut Books. There's some different people. So you can, if you go to my website, whentechfails.com, then you can click on links to purchase the books. And there are many bookstores that carry them. And certainly there's a lot of great free information and articles on whentechfails.com. And if you do click on the links there, it won't cost you any more and it helps support the website. You know, get a minor associates free from Amazon. But if you can order them through your local bookstore, there are some wholesalers in Europe, I believe, they are stocking both of these books. So you could order them from your local bookstore and they'll have their wholesalers deliver them. So if they don't stock them, they should be able to get them within a few days, even in Europe.
Right. Really good. WhenTechFails.com. That is the website. We're going to link that up for you as well so you can click through easily from our website. Much more to talk about in the next segment, Matt. It's going to be really interesting. So do stay with us. We'll be right back with more after this short break.
I am the heat. I am the rain. Rain, rain, rain all day. I am the rain. I'm gonna rain this weekend. I am the rain. I am the spy. Right.
with Matt Stein is coming up next, and this is really what you don't want to miss, as we'll discuss game-changing events such as nuclear disasters, EMPs, and solar storms. And allegedly we are overdue for a solar maximum here at the end of 2012. And if a super solar storm event occurs, what can we expect, and how should we prepare? Matt tells us how society's technology would be affected and mentions new technologies that can protect our transformers from a solar storm. Matt details the potential problems that could happen at nuclear plants surrounding sudden disaster. Then we'll discuss EMPs and the impact on our infrastructure. Stein mentions an interesting EMP-optimized weapon developed by Russia and China. Later we talk about what happens to the nuclear waste after we've made the shift into cleaner technologies. This is a very interesting second hour that you shouldn't miss. It's available right now in our members area. Sign up for a 3-month subscription and get full access to our website. We have a few different options and lengths available for you. We have archives going back to 2006 on all kinds of topics, some great material there for you that you can explore, consider, think about, and learn from. Next on Red Ice Radio, we have Stefan Molyneux from Free Domain Radio talking about philosophy, truth, reality, and statism. Then Jay Widener on Kubrick's Odyssey, a fascinating program. JJ Hertek and Desiree Hertek joins us after this to talk about The Keys of Enoch, some very interesting material. After this, William Davis, Mark Weber, Louise Turi, Mary Sean Young, Court Lindahl, Tom Horn, Dean Clifford, and Jordan Maxwell are coming on the program. Great guests, exciting and informative topics. You are welcome to return at any time and tune into our program. It's on demand, download or stream directly from the website or with our RSS feeds and apps. It couldn't be easier. But right now, more with Matthew Stein is coming up. All the information on how to listen can be found on redicecreations.com. Hey, stay with us. Don't miss this.